Papa, non, en 2024, créer un site web n'est plus une galère, c'est même devenu ultra simple, et notamment grâce à des solutions comme Squarespace. Squarespace est la plateforme tout en un pour permettre aux entrepreneurs de se démarquer et réussir en ligne, et ce, quelle que soit la taille de leur activité. Vous allez voir, tout y est. Vous pouvez vendre vos produits physiques ou services en un temps record. Vous avez des centaines de templates de sites web canon dans tous les domaines. Vous pouvez créer vos campagnes email. Vous pouvez même vendre votre propre formation en ligne. Donc, si vous voulez donner à votre business toutes les chances de se développer avec un outil à la fois performant et très simple d'utilisation, eh ben, je ne peux que vous recommander d'aller sur le site squarespace.com. En plus, à l'occasion de ce partenariat, Squarespace vous offre moins 10% sur votre première commande de site web ou de domaine avec le code Pauline. Alors, n'attendez plus et rendez-vous sur squarespace.com, code Pauline. Hello, hello mes chers amis, j'espère que vous allez bien. Ici Pauline Agneau et bienvenue dans un nouvel épisode du podcast. Je suis surexcitée par cet épisode, par cet invité qui me tardait d'avoir sur le podcast depuis des mois et des mois. Il s'agit d'un auteur américain qui s'appelle Daniel Pin. Et si vous ne le connaissez pas, eh bien écoutez bien cet épisode, je suis sûre que vous allez avoir envie de découvrir ses différents ouvrages. Avant qu'on rentre dans le vif du sujet, pour ceux qui ne connaîtraient pas encore ce podcast, eh bien, c'est un peu ma psychothérapie personnelle, j'ai envie de dire, ou un bon moment que je vais passer avec des invités, tous plus remarquables les uns que les autres. Vraiment, l'idée de ce podcast, c'est d'essayer d'avoir des personnalités qui nous inspirent, qui nous font réfléchir, en nous parlant de leur parcours, de leur philosophie de vie. Et c'est exactement ce qui a été le cas avec Daniel H. Pink. Donc Daniel Pink, comme je le disais, est un auteur et journaliste américain. Il est l'auteur de 5 livres traitant de l'évolution du monde du travail. Il a en particulier écrit un livre que j'ai beaucoup apprécié, sur lequel on a d'ailleurs démarré la conversation, qui s'appelle « The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward ». En d'autres termes, un livre sur le regret. Comment le regret, en réalité, est utile à nos vies. C'est vrai qu'on a toujours l'impression que le regret est quelque chose de négatif. Eh bien, Daniel aime bien aller contre les idées reçues, et en ça, je le rejoins, je dois dire, et nous fait réfléchir au sujet du regret. Dans cet épisode, on a également parlé de la notion de timing, parce que Daniel a écrit un livre également à ce sujet qui s'appelle « When, the scientific secrets of perfect timing », où il explique justement qu'on a chacun intérêt à vraiment se poser la question du quand, de quand faire quelque chose, quand prendre une décision, à quel moment de la journée. Véritablement, en réalité, chacun de nous a une sorte de chronomètre interne qui lui permettra d'être plus efficace si jamais il respecte un bon timing. On est parti un peu dans tous les sens, vous le verrez, mais j'ai pour ma part passé un excellent moment. J'espère que ce sera le cas pour vous également. Et d'ailleurs, si c'est le cas, n'hésitez pas, bien sûr, à me le dire sur les réseaux sociaux. Vous savez où me trouver, Pauline Agneau sur LinkedIn et Instagram, mais aussi à Daniel Pink, qui est actif également. Mais je ne vous en dis pas plus et laisse place à cette conversation en anglais avec Daniel Pink. Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
I'm extremely happy. So as I was saying just before we started the interview, I would have loved to have you in Paris. I would have loved to meet you in person. Maybe it'll be for a second round. I don't know if we have the opportunity, but thank you again for making the time. I'm sure the audience is going to be super, super happy with everything you have to say.
Well, thank you for having me.
No, of course. So my first question actually regards your new book. And I'd love really to start with this last book, The Power of Regrets. There's a quote I really wanted you to ponder upon and maybe to elaborate on, which is, I'm reading, "Regret is not dangerous or abnormal, a deviation from the steady path to happiness. It is healthy and universal, an integral part of being human. Regret is also valuable. It clarifies, it instructs. Done right, it needn't drag us down, it can lift us up." And that's very contrary to common
yes.
belief. So I would love for you to elaborate and explain how regrets can clarify or instruct, because of course, this is not a typical point of view.
Right. Well, at some level, that's what the entire book is about. So here's what we know. I mean, regret is, so let's be very clear here. Regret is an emotion. It's an emotion that makes us feel bad. So let's not dance around that. That when we feel that spear of regret, when we look backward, we wish we had done something different. We wish we had not done something. We wish we had done something in a different way. And it makes us feel bad. Now, here's what we know. That emotion is one of the most common emotions that human beings experience. We have 50 years of evidence telling us that just about every single human being experiences regret. The only people who do not experience regret are five-year-olds because their brains haven't developed that ability to travel through time. Certain kinds of neurodegenerative diseases and brain damage, and sociopaths. Otherwise, everybody has regret. Now, it's in a way to think of that is that it's part of our cognitive machinery. It is wired into our brains. It is part of who we are. Now, let's put those two ideas together. You have this emotion that is universal, that is ubiquitous, that everybody experiences, but it makes us feel bad. That's weird, right? It's everywhere, but it's aversive. I don't like experiencing regret, but I do because I'm a human being. So what's the point? There must be some reason for its ubiquity. And the reason is this: regret is useful if we treat it right. And once again, we have piles of evidence showing. Now, think about your listeners, Pauline, who are in business, who are trying to figure out their careers. We have evidence telling us that if we deal with our regrets properly, not ignoring them, not wallowing in them, but confronting them, using them as information, as signal, as data, it can help us become better negotiators. It can help us become clearer thinkers and avoid cognitive biases. It can help us become better and faster problem solvers. It can help us become better strategists. It can help us find more meaning. And so what we have is this universal emotion that is unpleasant, but that is a teacher, is an instructor. So what I'm trying to do here is give us a new view of regret, not this idea that we should never have regrets, an idea that is embodied by a French person, Edith Piaf, who famously sang, "Je ne regrette rien." I regret nothing, even though she died at a young age, racked by debt and drug addiction, full of regrets.
I mean, I would love to continue talking about this because, I mean, your book is such a powerful book in terms of, I think, insights that we ourselves sometimes refuse to see. And for me, it was really very, very, I mean, interesting to think about all those times when I had regrets. So I was wondering, do you yourself in your own path have maybe an example of a regret where you actually saw that this regret was useful, as you were saying just right now?
For me personally?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Many. Several. I'll give you one example of it. I'll give you one example here. So I have, earlier in my life, I have regrets about kindness. Now, one fairly common regret, and we can talk about how I collected some other regrets, regrets from around the world, but one fairly common regret that I collected in my own research were regrets that people had about bullying other people. Right. What's the French word for bully? Is there a word for that? Probably not.
We say there is a word. It's going to come back.
I don't know if that word translates all that well, but basically the idea is sort of mistreating other people. Not short of abuse, but in that direction. And so I have a lot of regrets about bullying other people. So forgive that detour there, because my regrets, I was never a bully. I never did anything like that. But when I was much younger, late teens, 20s, I was in many situations where people were not being treated well. They were being excluded. They were being left out. They were being treated unfairly. I saw it happen. I knew that it was wrong. And I did not do anything. Now, that has bothered me for decades. Okay, so here's the question. What do I do with that feeling? All right, so first of all, that is a feeling to take seriously. And the reason for that is this. You and I are talking, it is a Friday morning here in the East Coast of the United States. Yesterday was Thursday. I'm sure that yesterday I made many, many decisions and took many, many actions. Most of them I do not remember today, Friday. All right. So we make all kinds of decisions, take all kinds of actions in our life, most of which we do not remember. But here is an action, or really in this case, an inaction from decades ago. Decades ago. Not only do I remember it, but it makes me feel bad. That's a very strong signal. That is something we have to take seriously. So the question then is, how do I take that seriously? What I could do, which is the Edith Piaf strategy, I could say, je ne regrette rien, all right, and put my fingers in my ears. And, you know, that's a bad idea. That's a bad idea. I could be a typical American and say, I never look backward. I always look forward. I am always positive. I'm never negative. That's a bad idea, too. What I could also do is say, oh, my gosh, I am the worst person in the world. I am horrible human being. That's a bad idea as well. What I should be doing is saying, this is a signal. It's teaching me something. And what it's teaching me, what it's telling me, I think, are two things that you mentioned earlier, Paulie. First, it clarifies what I value. And this is something that was a surprise to me. I wouldn't necessarily say, before sort of processing this regret, that I value kindness. I don't know if I would say that about myself, but this is a signal that I actually do value kindness more than I might realize. So that's how it clarifies what I value. And it instructs me on how to do better, because I don't want to have this feeling again. So what am I going to do? Subsequently, in other kinds of encounters, where I see people being left out, being mistreated, being excluded, I say something. I do something. So it's instructing me on how to do better. And so this is why regret is so powerful. But we have to treat it properly. And the problem is that, you know, we have been indoctrinated in this Edith Piaf approach to things, where we say, I don't have any regrets. I never look backward. I always look forward. I forget about the negative, and I always focus on the positive. And that is not a useful recipe for living a good life or building a good career.
Is this something that happened? I mean, this shift, this phenomenon that now regret is deemed like something useless and not very interesting and just something that hurts. Is this a phenomenon that you observed happened in the last like 100 years, 200 years? Did you pinpoint like in history when this happened?
That's a really good question. And I did not. I don't know. It's a great question. I don't know. I tried to find that out, and it was a difficult thing to find out. I do trace a little bit of it. So I'm uncertain. I just want to be clear about that. I do have an inkling, a intuition, for whatever that's worth, that it is modern and American more than anything else. Modern meaning in the sense of the last 100 years, and actually fueled in part by the positive thinking movement that began in the United States in the mid 20th century. And here's the thing. It's like, I don't want to dismiss that because, you know, and by positive thinking movement, I don't mean the positive psychology movement of the late 20th century, which was a scientific exploration of human flourishing. I mean more kind of the Dale Carnegie, Norman Vincent Peale, mid 20th century, think positive, be sunny all the time. And here's the thing, like, that's not bad advice generally. It really isn't. I mean, optimism is a good thing. Positive emotions are a great thing. You know, we should have a lot of positive emotions. We should have way more positive emotions than negative emotions, but we shouldn't have only positive emotions. Again, going back to earlier in our conversation, because negative emotions are useful. They're there for a reason. They're telling us stuff. And when we line up the negative emotions in our lives, the most prevalent, and what science says is the most prevalent, and what I argue is the most powerful, is this emotion of regret.
So could we even argue that like regret is actually part of evolution, and that in a way we have evolved as a species that is capable of regretting for a reason, as you're saying, like And so the reason would be it makes us learn, it makes us think back, it makes us clarify, as you were saying. Is this, do you think this is something actually real?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we have to argue that. I think that I have never heard a counter argument to that. Okay. I mean, I think that is the logical conclusion. I think you've got it exactly right. Evolution is not designed to make us happy. It is designed to help us survive. That is real. Mm-hmm. So exactly as you're saying, Pauline, regret is obviously adaptive. It helps us adapt to our environment. It helps us survive. And this is why it's a little bit of a puzzle. I mean, I think the last two questions are actually very insightful questions, especially when we pair them together. So what we have is we have this movement telling us we should be positive all the time, but we have this evolutionary adaptation saying, no, 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 no. You don't want to be positive all the time because you won't survive. Yeah. You know, so there's a conflict between those two things that you see what I mean? That you're asking. Yeah. And so what we need to do is we need to say, as a human being, I have this big portfolio of emotions. We have all kinds of emotions. And again, a good life is full of positive emotions. Joy, awe, gratitude, elation, whatever. Those are fantastic. I want to have a lot of those emotions. I want you to have a lot of those emotions. But you don't want to have only those emotions. You have to have some negative emotions. Let me give you an example. Let's take fear, negative emotion. I don't like experiencing fear, but I would not, if there was some like doctor out there who said, I'll give you an operation where I'll go into your brain and I will beep, eradicate your ability to experience fear. I don't want that operation, because if I'm in a burning building, I want to experience fear because that's going to help me escape. Or think about an emotion like grief. Grief is a terrible emotion that human beings experience, but I wouldn't want to scrub away grief. Because the reason we experience grief is because we experience love. And grief, the loss of grief, helps us understand and appreciate the importance of love. So again, we don't want to Edith Piaf our way through regret. We don't want to wallow in the regret. We want to think about it. Use it as information. Use it as signal. Use it as data. Use it as a kind of clunk, 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 knock at the door.
How did you come to think about regrets and to decide to write a book on the subject?
I had regrets. I mean, it was, I think that a lot of the writers that you talk to on your show, the genesis, the birth of their exploration is often personal. And for me, it certainly was. I was at a point in my life where, to my surprise, I had room to look back. I went from being early in my working life, the youngest person in the room everywhere. And suddenly I looked around and I was the oldest person. I was doing projects with people who were 10 years younger than I was, 20 years younger than I was. And I suddenly realized I'd been writing books for 20 years. I had kids who were graduating from secondary school and university. And I was like, whoa, you know? And so I was at a point in my life where I could look backward. And when I look backward, because I'm a human being, I had some regrets, not terrible, devastating, overwhelming, debilitating regrets, but there were things I wish I had done that I didn't do. There were things I had done that I wish I didn't do. There were things I wish I had done differently. And what I found was that, I knew that nobody wanted to talk about regret. I knew that nobody wanted to have this conversation. And so I didn't want to talk about my own regrets. And I very tenderly began talking about some of these regrets with a few people. And I discovered that everybody wanted to talk about regret. That once I mentioned it, it was like, poosh! Everybody wanted to talk about it. And so as a writer, that's a very interesting idea. And so I wanted to make sure that this was not, I didn't want to write a book about my own personal regrets. That would be horrible. But I wanted to make sure that I wanted to make sure that, you know, I started doing, you know, making sure that there was some research out there. And it turned out there was way more research than I expected. And what's more, I felt like there were some holes in the research that I might be able to fill. So that took me on this, you know, 3-year journey into this emotion.
Well, thank you for writing it. I really, really incentivize people that are listening. If they, even if they don't feel concerned, actually, I think they can at one point in their life feel regret. And so I'm pretty sure that they will find this book helpful. So thank you for writing it. But with no segue, I'd love also to jump back in time and talk about your upbringing, your childhood, where you were raised, how was your family, and most importantly for me, how was little Daniel? Like, how were you as a child? How were you as a young boy?
Oh my.
Were you like, I'm sure that can be also very insightful, and we can understand a lot of things on the rest of your career thanks to that.
Okay. I'm not sure there's a huge amount of insight in there, but I'll try to answer your questions as best as possible, Pauline.
What did you want to be, when you wanted to grow up? What did you want to be in
life? It changed over time. You know, I grew up in a lot of people in Europe know about, you know, when they think about the United States, they think about maybe New York or Washington or San Francisco or Los Angeles. But there's this whole section in the middle of the United States where a lot of people live, and that's where I grew up. I grew up in the middle, what did I want to be when I grew up? At one point, I wanted to be like a movie writer and director, but at other points, I wanted to be a sportscaster, and at other points, I wanted to be I didn't have any like super strong inclinations. At a certain point, when I got to be in my teens, I became keenly interested in politics, and you know, I think that was the strongest pull when I was younger.
Were you already interested in books and reading and writing, or
I was always a reader. I was always a reader. I was very, you know, again, a lot of times we're product of the bizarre circumstances of our upbringing, and I happen to grow up in a part of the United States, the state of Ohio, that has arguably the best public library system in the United States of America. And so I grew up in a small town that had an excellent public library that was an 11-minute walk from my parents' house. And there was also a very, very large, in the city of Columbus, which is the capital of the state of Ohio, there was a very large central public library downtown, just a massive, huge library that was just a bus ride away. So I spent a lot of time in libraries when I was a kid.
And how did you start actually writing? What was the trigger that, you know, made you interested from politics and then go to writing?
I'm not sure. I actually don't know. I was working in politics. I think that it was something that I was always intrigued by. It's something that I always kind of did as a hobby in a weird way. So even when I was in university, you know, I was, my concentration was linguistics, which is a very kind of mathematical social science. You have a lot of, even now you have a lot of like computer programmers studying linguistics, you know, computer scientists and things studying linguistics and things like that. It's a very, very mathematical, it was social science, but also just the approach of it was quite mathematical. And so that's what I studied. But I also ended up winning a short story prize just because on the side, I wrote a short story. And so it's just something I did as kind of a hobby. And then as time evolved and I was working in politics, I realized that what I was doing on the side was probably what I should be doing in the center. So that's it. So there's not, you know, I wish there was a neater, cleaner story involving epiphanies and waking up in the middle of the night with a stark realization, but that's not how it unfolded.
No, but I'm sure the decision of, you know, shifting, a lot of people listening to this podcast are people also that, you know, think about their careers and sometimes want it to evolve. And I mean, a shift from politics, which is, I mean, maybe a little bit more, not mainstream, it's not what I mean, but I mean, in terms of, it seemed that it's more secure, you know, in terms of lifestyle, I would say. And then going as a writer is very entrepreneurial in a way. I mean, you're alone, you have to write to earn your own money. I'm sure this was also a shift that was not that easy to make. And
yeah,
so I'd love for you.
Sure. I'm glad you raised that, because so let's talk about that, because I think it's very important to in terms of the guidance for other people. So we'll come back to that, the risks, in a moment, but let's start with the fundamental thing, which is, you know, sort of what we were talking about, which is that I think when we're young and we look at people who are doing things that are reasonably interesting, we think that they got there in this simple, smooth, upward trajectory, a very simple line up like that. And it's never that way. It's up and back and down and up and progress and setbacks and detours and whatnot. Mm. And so I think it's really important for people early in their working lives to understand that the path is not simple. It's not straight. It's full of ups and downs and detours. And that's just part of the journey. So I think that's one thing. So, you know, I would much rather tell you, part of me would rather tell you a very neat and tidy story, but that's not a true story. The true story is messy and untidy and full of fits and starts. So I think that's important to understand. Now, to the other question that you had, which has to do with moving from a, you know, at least a job with a regular salary to essentially to going out on my own. I think that when people do that, it's extremely important to take risks, but you have to take sensible and calculated risks. So in this particular case, when I went to do this, I was married. I still am married. It's the same person. I was married, but my wife had a job. When I went out on my own, my wife did not leave her job. She did not leave her steady salary. So we knew we had one salary coming in. We were not making a ton of money because we were both working for the government, federal government. But we did not give up her salary here in the United States. This will be bizarre for Europeans, is that, you know, we do not have universal health insurance. And so the health insurance we have comes from a job. So my wife, we had a little kid at the time. She did not give up her salary. She did not give up her health insurance. Well, we made this calculated risk. I'm going to try to go out on my own. We also said, we'll try this for a couple of years and see if it works. If it doesn't work, we'll go to the next part of the story. And so it was a very calculated risk. One of the things that I believe in deeply for people who are doing things that are entrepreneurial is I think that people sometimes don't pay enough attention to costs. And low overhead and being frugal. So I have been working for myself for over 20 years. I have never had an office outside of my house. I have never paid rent to anybody else. And so I always have extremely low, always have had extremely low overhead. I'm talking to you from an office that is the garage behind my house. I live 22 steps in that direction. And so I've never had an office outside of the house. I've never paid rent to anybody else. So I think that being frugal and being calculated about the risk is important. And so I believe it. So I think that many times people don't take enough risk in their life and in their careers. But when I say that, it doesn't mean try it, throw it all away, forget. That's not how you do it. You do it in a smart, strategic way.
Yeah, I get with you. So I'm an entrepreneur too. I have this podcast, but I have a company with about 75 people. And it's funny because people always say to me, when I want to launch a business, I want to go all in. I want really, because otherwise I will not believe that it will work out. And so I need basically in a way to put all the risks possible on the table. And what I hear from what you're saying is quite intelligent, of course, is that you're saying, okay, you can be motivated. You want to do your best, but at the same time, you also have to be realistic in a way and just try to mitigate your risks. And so
absolutely. I mean, I understand the impulse of saying you're going all in. And I think that at some level, what you want to do is you want to go all in emotionally. You want to go all in intellectually. I'm all for that. But just you want to be smart about it. It's like there's a reason, you know, okay, so, you know, for I'm trying to think. You know, you have a car, an automobile, and you have insurance on the automobile. You have a house, you have insurance on the house. You want to actually manage that risk. I think it's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about this fully. You do want to go all in some respects. I agree with that completely. You know, so when you go in and you say, like, I'm going to do everything I can to make this work, but you don't bet everything. You actually are a much more sophisticated risk manager.
Yeah. I'd love to talk about your current way of organizing your work and yourself. Sure. So you were saying you've been working for 20 years as a writer, and you work. So you told us everything, your garage, etc. What are the main challenges for you as a person, as a writer, in terms of organization, to be as productive, as motivated as possible?
Yeah, it's a great, really good question. When I write, so when I'm working on a book or, you know, any kind of big project that mostly that involves writing, I stick to a very rigid routine. I'm a believer in routines. If I were to come out to this office and write only when I was inspired, only when I, you're laughing, you know what it's like, all right?
I'm like you.
if I waited till I was inspired, or I'm in the mood, or I'm, you know, the muse is speaking to me, I would not have gotten anything done. So I treat writing, again, this is my approach. I think it's good advice in general, but I'm not sure it works for everybody.
Of course.
I treat writing like being a, well, I've said this before, I treat writing a little bit like being a bricklayer. So my job is to come out to my workplace, and I come out at, you know, typically when I'm in, when I'm writing, is typically around 8:30 in the morning. So I don't start insanely early, but I don't come in very late, you know, 8:30, I think pretty reasonable starting time. And I give myself a word count. You have to write 600 words, 800 words, whatever it is, depends on where I am in a project and whatnot. And I do not do anything until I hit that word count. I do not bring my phone with me into the office. I do not answer my email. I do not watch sports highlights on YouTube. I do not do anything until I hit that word count. Once I hit that word count, I'm allowed to do other things. So I do that. So let's say I start that on a Monday. I do that on Monday. Then I come into the office on Tuesday and I do the same thing. And then I do it on Wednesday and on Thursday and on Friday. And if you do that every day, the words begin to pile up. And that's how I do it. So I'm pretty rigid in my approach to these kinds of things. So I do my writing in the morning. I do my interviews and administrative stuff in the afternoon. I almost, you know, try to almost every day exercise in some way in the late afternoon. And that's how I do it.
How did you come up with this strategy? Did you have to put this routine on place? Because before you tried to do it like in a more, let's say, spontaneous way, and you realized that it was just not working?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what happened. And then also, you know, a few years ago, I wrote a book about timing and the effect of time of day and so forth. And I realized that there was this time of day for me, not for everybody, but for me, that was the most effective, and I was squandering it. So, yeah.
I love this book, by the way. I read it too. And I would love for you maybe segue on this book, because I wanted to mention it too. Could you quickly just explain the main insight of the book?
The one on timing?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a book called When in English, very easy book to translate into other languages. Unlike some of these other books. So I wrote a book called Drive that does not translate well into other, I don't even know what the French title of Drive. But the title in other languages for a book called When is pretty easy. And this is a book about timing. And essentially the idea is that when we make our decisions, just like we were talking about, Pauline, when we make our decisions about when to do things, when should I work? When should I start a project? When should I end a project? We tend to make them based on guesses. We tend to make them based on intuition. And that's the wrong way to do it, because there is a massive, in this case, massive amount of research giving us instruction on when in the day we should do certain kinds of work, when in the day we should do other kinds of work, when should we take a break, How do beginnings affect us? How do midpoints affect us? How do endings affect us? How do people synchronize in time? And so this is a look trying to draw from this incredible, vast trove of science to give people instruction on when to do things.
Yeah, I remember when I read the book, it really like dawned on me that actually I was a very analytical person in the morning, and all my tasks that needed, you know, that required, and I guess this is pretty common, that
yes.
require a lot of like intellectual power basically needed to be in the morning. And usually what I realized when I looked at my schedule is that it was exactly the opposite. Usually I would come into the office, have all my meetings in the morning. So it'd be more like, you know, and so I completely, and I thank you, changed my way of organizing my week. Thanks to your book.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, me too. So I now, you know, I often do, like, I mean, the big scourge is really email. That if one of the, if you are like, so some of this has to do, just to give a little bit of context to your listeners here, some of this has to do with what's known as a chronotype, which is that we, biologically, we have certain inclinations. Some of us naturally wake up late and go to sleep late. Some of us naturally wake up early and go to sleep early, and many of us are kind of in the middle. But in general, you have people who sort of are more like, about 80% of people are more like you and me, which is like, in general, we, you know, sort of hit our peak early in the day. There's about 20% of the population are night owls. They hit their peak way later in the day, and that's a little bit different for them. But for people like you and me, which is roughly, I'm oversimplifying, but about 80% of the population, you're much better off doing your heads down, focused, analytic work, work that requires vigilance, work where you do not want to be distracted. You want to do that early in the day rather than later in the day. And unfortunately, many of us, myself included, what do we do in the morning? We respond to our blizzard of email, we have a meeting or two, and suddenly it's lunchtime. And then we end up doing what is often our most important and most difficult work in the afternoon, which for many of us is the absolute worst time of day to do it.
Yeah, exactly. So that was exactly my situation. And I think a lot of people that are listening to us are probably in this case. What I thought interesting in the book too is that it really was a way for me to take back control on my schedule. And basically, I was in a situation, and I guess it's the case of a lot of people who basically have their schedule, their calendar that is, let's say, how can I say this in English? Well, they're just responding to inputs, you know, and to emails and to people asking for a meeting. And so basically they're really not in charge of their own meeting and their whole schedule. They're really like getting just the schedule of other people in their own.
Yeah. 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 I'm curious about how you would say that in French, because I have an inkling of what you might be trying to say in English. Like, it's almost like you're being reactive. You're reacting
rather than being
intentional. And I think that's a huge part of this, that we're not, I think that's a huge, that we're not intentional enough about our schedule. We're sort of passive and reactive rather than intentional and strategic about it all. And the reason for that is that, and this is weird too, because we actually are pretty intentional about other aspects of our work. You have 75 employees. You were intentional about who you hired. You didn't say, Jean-Claude wants a job here. Great, come on in. You're intentional about that, about who you work with. You're intentional about what you do and how you do it. But when it comes to when we do things, we're not intentional. We are reactive. Yeah. And that's a bad idea.
What's funny, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, is that I really feel that your books are often about reframing something that is reactive and making it active. Even for regrets, we were talking about regrets earlier on. If I go back to our earlier conversation, you're saying basically we could be just reacting to our own regrets, being sad about them, you know, not really understanding them. What you're saying and what you're doing with your books is always saying, no, okay, I want to be intentional about regret.
Yeah.
It's a signal and I want to use it as something useful.
I think so. I mean, I think you're elevating my own intention as a writer a little bit, but I think that's a consequence of some of those things is that, yeah, I mean, there's a I'll give you something I think about. There's a American from the early 20th century named William James. William James was a Harvard professor. He was essentially the father, parent of psychology as we think of it, psychology as the study of human behavior. He taught the first psychology class. He wrote the first psychology textbook. And so it's an interesting figure. And he has this line in some of his work where he says, I'm going to get it mostly right, but I'm going to get the main part right. He says, most of us go through life, and here's the phrase, only half awake, only half awake. And when you think about that, like that really stuck with me. And I think that a lot of us go through life, only half awake. And what we want to do is we want to be in every aspect of our life, we want to be fully awake. You know, we want to be completely awake, and many of us are not. And if we go back to the sort of personal side of it, I think that in some level, maybe the books that I write are ways to help me become fully awake. And I don't want, I mean, we're on this planet, we're alive for such a vanishingly short amount of time that I don't want to go through that incredibly short amount of time that I'm alive half asleep. And I think that if we are fully awake to our lives, we're going to lead better lives. We're going to be happier. We're going to contribute more. We're going to have better relationships. So I think that maybe sort of at the white hot center of all of it is my own fear of being only half awake.
What were other occurrences where you felt you needed to wake up in a way, and there's regrets, maybe timing, you were saying, other pivotal moments where you realize
I'm not a big fan of pivotal moments, because I think that these things happen more slowly and on the edges. But I wrote a book about selling, and how basically my observation that you and I and essentially everybody listening to your podcast are selling all the time, even if they don't have the word sales in their job, even if they don't have the selling in their job description, that all of us at some level are selling, persuading, influencing all the time, no matter what our job is, whether we're a designer, whether we're a software engineer, whether we're a teacher or a physician or a nurse, we are persuading all the time. And so I realized that about myself. I wanted to do it better and do it in a way that wasn't sleazy. And so I ended up writing a book about that to help me become more fully awake to that.
Super interesting. Daniel, I have another few questions for you that are a little personal, you'll see. One of them, yeah, I know. Don't worry. One of them is, have you lived in your life a great failure? And most importantly, the lesson that you took from this mistake or this failure?
I don't know if I've had a great colossal failure, but I've had a series of just small failures on many, many dimensions. I mean, there were, dozens of jobs that I applied for that I didn't get. There were scholarships I applied for that I didn't get. I tried to, I had this business idea built on this, a book that I had written. It was a complete failure. It went nowhere. It was a complete, utter flop. There have been all kinds of other small things that I've tried that were colossal failures. And so, I don't point to a single mega failure, but I can list literally dozens of things that were. And So the question then is that, what do you do with that? And it's actually another way to process regret. And so one of my favorite ideas, I'm going to give some more practical advice here. One of my favorite ideas is from Tina Seelig at Stanford, who has this idea of a failure resume, that what we should do is that we should catalog all these failures. And so I've done that myself, where you basically make, here's how you do it. You make a long list of your failures, your setbacks, your screw-ups, your mistakes, right? That's only the beginning. Then in another column, you list what lesson you learned from it. And then in the third column, you list what you're going to do about it. And when I did that, what I found, I think it's a great exercise. It's not pleasant, but I think it's a useful exercise. What I found when I did that was that when I listed a lot of those failure setbacks and things, was that in some cases, there was not a lesson. That sometimes we fail and screw up, and there isn't a lesson from it. It's just that there's randomness. There's luck.
Yeah.
Sometimes things don't work out. And I actually think that thinking about that is helpful. Like, that to me was sort of a relief. That's the good news. The bad news is that when I listed the lessons, I found myself learning, making the same two mistakes over and over and over and over again. And being explicit, to go back to the word that we've been talking about a lot in English, intentional. When you're intentional about saying, thinking through your failures, what you realize is that what I realized is that I wasn't being strategic enough in examining my own failures, and as a consequence, I was repeating them over and over again. There were two core mistakes that I kept making over and over and over and over and over and over again.
Super interesting. Yeah, because I think usually we, as you were saying, we really focus our attention on one big failure, and we don't realize that actually most of our failures are always the same failure repeating itself. So that's,
I certainly didn't realize that for myself until I did this exercise. And actually seeing those in person, seeing those right in front of me was really helpful in terms of sort of making sense of my own life, but also avoiding those mistakes in the future.
Of course. So this is a great question for you, I think, Daniel, because it's about regret in a way. If you could change anything in your personal or professional life, what would you do differently?
I feel like I earlier in my life should have spent more time devoted to a single thing and gotten really good at that. For instance, I can't play any musical instrument. I took 6 years of French in secondary school and in university. I can't speak French.
On aurait pu faire le podcast en français alors.
Ah, non. Je ne peux pas parler français. Je parle français comme une vache de Ohio. So I never really devoted myself. I was never great at a single sport. I never learned a musical instrument. I never mastered fully another language. And I think that I would have devoted, and I think we're better off doing those kinds of things when did you start learning English?
Oh, when I was quite young, I think probably like around six or something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So to me, it's like, if I had to go back, I would take, to your earlier question, I would take 6 year old me, and I don't even care what it is. It could be the saxophone. It could be tennis. It could be Spanish, but something where I was deeply devoted to mastering that particular thing. So today, as a 50 something, I would be, you know, we could have this conversation, you know, in Spanish, or we could I could take an interlude from this conversation and play my saxophone, or, you know, I would be a great master's tennis player or something like that, or a great master's basketball player or something like that, or a master's swimmer or something like that. So I think that's what I would do.
Is there a quote or words of wisdom that really means something deeply for you and that you could share with us?
Sure. I have some of them up on my wall here. One of them is from an artist. I don't want to say who the artist is. Because his reputation has gone downhill in recent years, but I think the quotation is still valid. And, this artist says, Inspiration, I'm reading it from my wall over there. Inspiration is for amateurs. Inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work.
Love it. Love it.
And we were talking about that. We were talking about that before. Yeah, but exactly. I like the idea. Inspiration is for amateurs. Professionals show up and do their work. I'll give you another one. This is also from I don't think that anybody in France would know who this is, so I'll save it, but it's from an American basketball player, former basketball player, who says, she said that being a professional is doing what you love to do, even on the days you don't feel like doing it. That's what it means to be a professional. So I think a lot about, like, what does it mean to be an amateur and what does it mean to be a professional? And what professionals do is they show up and they do their work.
They do the work.
They show up and they do the work, and they don't, it doesn't matter whether you don't feel like it, doesn't matter whether you're not inspired, you show up because that's your job and you're a professional.
Now I have a little non-politically correct question. Is there something that you believe that is usually not a shared belief? For instance, I had someone on the podcast telling me, like, I don't believe that older people are actually wiser. Actually, they have a lot of cognitive biases, and so they're actually more unwise. So do you have one of these?
That's interesting. That's a great question. I would love to see a kind of a compilation of people's answers.
I think I will. It's a good idea.
Fascinating. It's a wonderful question. I'd love to hear other people's answers to it. So it's a question, something that I believe that is controversial or that other people won't necessarily agree with. I'll give you one, so it's not politically correct, but I'll give you two things. Genes matter. Human beings are not endlessly malleable. So if we go back to what we were talking about just a moment ago, all right? So I would love to have gotten great at a sport, but chances are that I don't have the innate abilities to be a great, great, great athlete. I can be a pretty good one, but I don't care what you could have sent me to. You know, I could have devoted my entire childhood to training to be a professional athlete and probably would not have made it because I didn't have the innate abilities to it, because genes matter. Mm. They matter for things that we care about deeply. Genes matter for, they're not determinative, but they matter for intelligence. They matter for all kinds of things in illness. And I think that we do not have a sophisticated enough understanding that there's a lottery of birth. That is, there's a lottery of who you're born, where, you know, the circumstance in which you're born to, but was also as one writer talks about it in a very good book with this title, there's a genetic lottery too. And we were very uncomfortable talking about that.
So it requires also being very aware about your own shortcomings or talents and trying, I guess, to go in the direction of your talents more than trying to just be the best as you can at something where you don't
the idea that all of us can be good at anything, can be really good at anything, is ludicrous.
Well, thank you for sharing it, because I think I share the same belief, and I must say it's quite controversial.
Yeah. What's one that you have? What's a belief that you have that is unorthodox or controversial or not widely shared?
You know, that's a good question. And because I'm on the other end of the podcast, nobody ever asked me this question. So I would need to think about it too. What would I say? I'm sure I have many.
Yeah.
I would need to think more about
it.
So
that's
you
fine.
See
yeah.
now
yeah.
I see that the exercise is actually quite difficult. I'll think about it and I'll share it maybe in the introduction.
Okay, cool.
Is there a subject on which you have changed your mind? Could be recently, could be
a few
years ago.
It's interesting because it's tied to the last question, which is this is partly my it's going to sound less insightful, I think, to a European audience than to, but here in America, we have this belief that, you know, all things are possible, that everybody can achieve, that that, you know, everybody can just pull themselves up by their bootstraps and accomplish things. And what I found in my own life is that the circumstances of your birth matter far, forget about genetics for a moment.
Mm.
The circumstances of your birth matter far more than I ever realized. I used to be have that very American belief that it doesn't matter your station of life, everybody. And when I look at how the real world works, and particularly this is true of being a parent, and I look at, you know, here in Washington, D.C., their kids, I think about this all the time, their kids who were born on, our son is visiting from university, you know, he's a break in university right now. And so he's 20 years old. And 20 years ago, on the day that he was born, there was another kid born in Washington, D.C. on that same day, probably just a few miles away. And my son had advantages from the moment of his birth that some other kid did not have. And that we have to think about whether, and I used to say, well, it doesn't matter. It's like everybody can achieve. It's all, you know, there's a slight disadvantage, but it doesn't last and it lasts. So, so that's something I've changed my mind on about basically just the basic level of fairness in society.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, very true. So just to go back on your question to me, I think I would answer, but maybe because we're in this conversation, one of my answers could be that actually, I don't believe that people really change. I think people can evolve, but I don't really believe that they can change. And this is a shared belief that, you know, as a woman, you can change your husband or vice versa, or you can change professionally. I don't really believe it's true. I think you can slightly evolve. I think you can better yourself, but I don't really think that fundamentally you can change.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think that you might be right about that. It's an interesting line of inquiry.
Maybe a new book.
So I don't know. I mean, so for instance, like I think that it is there is this idea that when people are exposed to difficulty or trauma, that it is inevitably debilitating and harmful. When in fact, I think that actually people are much more resilient than we give them credit for, and that we're uncomfortable recognizing that. We're uncomfortable I think there are people who experience trauma and it's devastating. There's no question about that. But I think there are plenty of people who experience trauma and difficulty, and they're much more resilient than we expect.
Yeah. Have you read the book from Nassim Nicholas Taleb, Anti-Fragile?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know that I read the first one, the first one he did, because it's the same book. So I think that there's something there. I think that he's talking really more at the system level. I'm talking at the individual personality level. So, for instance, we know we understand post-traumatic stress, and that's real. That's the thing. I don't want to dismiss that. But we've given short shrift to this idea of post-traumatic growth, that there are people who experience trauma, difficulty, and actually grow as a result of that.
Hmm. My last question for you is there a book that has had a great impact on you that maybe even changed the way you were thinking, that you know made you think about life differently? It could be literature, it could be a comic book, it could be anything really.
Yeah, I mean, this is similar to the question we were talking about before, is that, you know, I love to offer a neat, tidy explanation that there's a single book, and I felt one way before I read the book, and suddenly the world looked differently after I did. And I don't think that's really the case. I'll give you one that had a big effect on me, which is, it's a very recent book called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. He's a social psychologist now at NYU, and it's a book about... it's a book about moral reasoning, and what it says essentially is that when we have this fantasy that when we come to conclusions about moral topics, so something like should there be death penalty, capital punishment? Should abortion be legal? Should there be? I mean, here in the States, it's more or less resolved, but you know, a few years ago, two men or two women be permitted to marry each other. We think that what we do is we reason through the issues, weigh the pluses and minuses, the rights and responsibilities, and then come to a reasoned conclusion, when in fact, that's not how we do it at all. We have an emotional, instinctive response to that, and then we use reason to justify those instinctive emotional responses. And I didn't know any of the research about this beforehand. I read that book and it's fundamentally changed how I think about that aspect of life. And it certainly has big effect on our politics.
So you mean our values basically need to be, usually we use our values. We are not very aware that we're doing that. And then we try to justify them with rational explanations.
Right. We think that on a controversial issue, whatever, anything that's morally freighted, we think that on a controversial issue, the controversial issues are a little bit different in the US and in France, but let's take something like,
It could be euthanasia, for instance.
Euthanasia,
great
example. All right, euthanasia, perfect, great example. We say, should euthanasia be, or even things like, let's take something like assisted suicide. That is like, should somebody who wants to be able to end their life at will? And what we do is we say, I think yes, because, and we have this very rational explanation of it. I think no, and we have this very rational explanation of it, but the sequence is off. Essentially what happens is that we come to an emotional, visceral conclusion, and then we use reason to justify that. So the sequence is, the sequence is off. And so you see this in politics, you see this in the way that, that judges reason, and I think that our, and so anyway, I think it's a fundamentally, a monumentally important book, The Righteous Mind by John Haidt.
Thank you for sharing it. Thank you so much. Daniel, this is the end of this interview. Is there a last, thing you want to say, a last request, a last insight you want to share with our audience before we wrap this up?
I think that the one last thing that comes out from the book and regret is that one of the things that you see very clearly in my own research and in some of the other research is that over time, what people regret are their inactions rather than their actions. Over time, what people regret are the things they did not do rather than the things that they did do. And I think that suggests that what we want to have in our lives is a bias for action, a bias for experimentation, a bias for trying things. Because as we age, especially, what haunts us, what sticks with us, what vexes us to our dying days are the things we didn't do. We didn't start that business. We didn't speak up for something that mattered to us. We didn't ask that person out on a date. We didn't go on that trip. We didn't reach out to a friend. So I think that having that bias for action is actually a greater appetite for sensible risk is important.
I don't know if you know, but there's a saying in French, mieux vaut des remords que des regrets. It means better have remorse than regrets.
Right.
I don't know if this exists in in American.
No. But, I mean, there's the Tennyson line. It's better about romance. It's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. Similar. Mm. Yeah. So, but I wish I had known that line. I didn't know that. Because remorse and regret are different, because remorse is essentially about I took an action. And I wish I had not taken that action. But when we take an action, there are things that we can do to, if I've hurt somebody, I can make amends. I can apologize. I can make a repair. But for inactions, you can't do anything. They stick with you. They stick with us and vex us forever and ever.
Daniel, thank you so much for taking the time. The book is called The Power of Regrets, not yet translated in French, I think, but maybe it will happen soon.
Soon, yes. I think it's very soon, because I know we had the deal for the last year. So we'll see.
So should happen soon. Anyway, I'll point to the book.
And the thing is, it's like some of it's already in French because I have all these Edith Piaf lyrics in there.
Exactly.
That doesn't even need translation. Non, rien de rien.
Non, rien de rien.
Yeah.
Je ne regrette rien. Yeah. Thank you so much. If people want to find you on the internet, what's the best way to contact you or to continue following you? I know you're on Instagram.
DanielPink.com. DanielPink.com. I'm not a huge fan of social media, but I have a website that you can find and access pretty easily.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Daniel. See you soon.
Thank you.
Bye bye les amis, c'est la fin de cet épisode, mais avant de vous quitter, quelques détails en plus. D'abord, pour toutes les infos sur le podcast et cet épisode, ça se passe sur polinegno.com, vous aurez tout promis, juré. Aussi, si vous souhaitez me contacter pour me poser des questions, me proposer de nouveaux invités, eh bien n'hésitez pas à le faire directement sur LinkedIn, Instagram ou YouTube, je vous attends. Enfin, encore mille merci de m'avoir écouté jusqu'ici, j'espère de tout cœur que ça vous a plu et je vous dis à très vite pour un nouvel épisode.